From the studios of United Nations Radio New York, this is Perspective. An in-depth look at some of the views behind the headlines.
Hello and welcome to the program. In this edition, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights turns 60.
Jaru al-Khachin, Carta
and Denis. Declaration Universelle des Droits de l'Homme.
Pandaigdig na pagpapahayag na makarapatan ng tao.
Universal na Declaration y Diretso Siha para Itautaw.
I wanted to create something where everybody was saying the same thing, and I wanted it to be something that expressed this common humanity. So the Declaration of Human Rights was a perfect vehicle for that.
And of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and
Brenda Ray is the creative director of the World Voices Project. She was looking for a text to be read in as many different languages as possible.
Article 1.
Bedo jinyao dodo. Oji agbeto kata ablodevio.
I went on the UN's website and started snooping around and saw how many translations there were and was thrilled because to me it was just a natural, it was a gold mine that something is already pre-translated and I can have people from all of these different cultures reading the exact same thing.
Anqaz klitte nefsu kefseb bizer'i biqalem bizota.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most translated document in the world.
Craig Makiber is with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He says there is no doubt that this document, translated into more than 360 languages, reflects the aspirations of all of humanity.
You often will have governments claiming that, well, these are not our rights, these are Western or Northern or imposed rights, a charge often made by governments for all the wrong reasons, I think, but you will never hear that from the people.
Mr. Makiber points out that all cultures around the world have traditions, codified in certain ways, that include notions of dignity, equality, justice, and freedom. But Elazar Barkin, a historian at Columbia University in the U.S., says these concepts have evolved considerably.
There's no doubt that all civilizations have aspects from which we can draw principles that are part of contemporary human rights. And it exists in the Bible, and it exists in the Quran, and it exists in Eastern texts, in India and in China, and it exists in Hammurabi or in the Cyrus Cylinder, or for that matter with Native Americans. However, I think that it's important to recognize that while there is a genealogical continuity, there is a significant difference with contemporary human rights, with the idea that it is not just appreciation of the humanity of individuals, but actually lack of discrimination, which actually doesn't exist in ancient civilizations. So that is a hugely important component of contemporary human rights that doesn't exist in the past.
Women's rights, the rights of disabled persons, and children's rights are among those that have enriched the concept of human rights in the past half century, Mr. Barkin explains. And he believes the concept of human rights will continue to evolve as our expectations grow. Craig Makiber agrees that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted on December 10, 1948, is a product of its time.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is as much a product of the horror felt after the Second World War as was the founding of the United Nations itself. This document was written when the embers of the war were still quite warm and the memories still quite fresh of widespread atrocities, including genocide, being perpetrated on continents across the globe. And in that honeymoon period for international relations after the war, there was a sense that there needed to be a new international order based upon a recognition that human beings do in fact have rights and that those rights are inalienable.
Soviet Union.
The General Assembly President at the time, Herbert Evatt of Australia,
yes.
Took a roll call and announced the results.
Yes.
The voting on the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is as follows. In favor of adoption, 48. Against adoption, none. Abstentions, 8. so that we reached the stage, gentlemen, in which by an enormous vote and without any direct opposition, this Assembly has adopted this very important declaration.
Mr. Evatt went on to say that this was the first occasion on which the organized community of nations made a declaration of human rights and fundamental freedoms. The adoption of the declaration, notes historian Elazar Barkin, was also quite an achievement for its time.
This is a UN that was quite young, and we have to remember that this was a Soviet Union that did not support it but did not block it, that was headed by Stalin. So we have to recognize that this is a very different time in history when such a thing was embraced. It was not that human rights was a given situation. This was a major breakthrough.
And yet it might never have happened were it not for the determination of one person, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the first chair of the UN Human Rights Commission. Margaret Bruce worked alongside her as a junior human rights officer at the time.
When the commission was meeting and they had serious divisions, she would call a meeting of the disputing powers to her home in, usually it was Manhattan, and let them talk in a more informal setting and try and sort out their differences. That's the kind of thing she did.
Not only was Mrs. Roosevelt one of the principal driving forces of the Universal Declaration, but she defined human rights in a way that seems enduringly relevant in today's world.
Where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any map of the world. Yet they are the world of the individual person. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, and equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere. Without concerted action to uphold them close to home, we shall look in vain for progress in the larger world.
The Declaration was a statement of intent, or an ideal, that was not in itself enforceable. Margaret Bruce says there was little the UN could do at the time against violators of human rights, but informed them of the complaints against them.
I was one of the officers assigned to receive all these allegations of violations and tell them that the UN really couldn't take any action. That has changed a lot since those days.
The principles of the Declaration have since been translated into legally binding international treaties. They are also echoed in the constitutions of more than 90 countries. There are now dedicated mechanisms, including the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Human Rights Council, with its independent experts to monitor, protect, and further develop human rights. Craig Machiber says the founders of the Universal Declaration could hardly have foreseen some of these developments.
In spite of the revolutionary idea of empowering international mechanisms to deal with human rights, their vision was quite a humble one. They could not have imagined at that time these monitoring mechanisms in the very, I must say, intrusive ways that international organizations now address human rights questions, and I think they'd be quite pleased to see the way that that has developed. At the same time, I think they may be horrified to see that 60 years after the prohibition of torture in such clear terms, it is now being defended by people in the mainstream, sometimes the mass media, often governmental officials, parliamentarians, and others. So I think they'd be a bit worried that we need to really recommit ourselves in making sure that these rights are off the table, beyond debate, and as firmly rooted as the Universal Declaration intended them to be.
The Universal Declaration was visionary, says UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navanathem Pillay, and it is truly the foundation of all the legislation and enforcement mechanisms that came after it.
It deliberately set the bar extremely high, and in many of its aspirations was years ahead of its time. For the first time, all human rights were recognized as belonging inherently to all people, rather than being gifts magnanimously bestowed upon them or denied to them by design, fate, or whim of ruling regimes. It then lays out a list of specific rights ranging from the right not to be tortured, enslaved, or arbitrarily detained, via the rights to freedom of opinion, expression, and religion, to a range of key social, economic, and cultural rights, such as education, health, and the right to equal pay for equal work. Everyone, says the Declaration, is entitled to these rights without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion.
Kenneth Roth, director of the non-governmental organization Human Rights Watch, accepted one of the UN's Human Rights Prizes this year on behalf of his organization. He pointed out that maybe the greatest strength of the Universal Declaration was that it gave rise to the human rights movement.
And this movement has been able to counter the temptation of every government to violate human rights, because it's a very easy way to cling to power or to get things done if you just, you know, censor that opposition newspaper or get rid of that pesky opposition leader or scapegoat a vulnerable minority. The human rights movement has been able to make it possible for governments to pay a price if they indulge that temptation to violate human rights. And we do that by investigating, exposing, and shaming governments that violate human rights. We work with influential governments to put economic and diplomatic pressure on abusive governments. We're able to see that in the worst situations of genocide, war crimes, or crimes against humanity, that repressive individuals are brought to justice before things like the International Criminal Court. And we have pushed to make real the responsibility to protect by ensuring that peacekeepers and others are deployed where there's an urgent need.
Ms. Pillay noted that the power of ordinary citizens to confront human rights abuses has been furthered by the Internet.
The advent of the Internet means that those who wish to abuse their citizens behind closed doors find it much harder to do so, and those who wish to expose such abuses can do so more easily.
The High Commissioner says, however, that we cannot be complacent about these achievements.
We, of course, cannot stop here. We are still 60 years on, a very long way from achieving the goals laid down in the Universal Declaration. I don't believe that any country in the world can sit back complacently and say we're there. Tens of millions of people around the world are still unaware that they have rights that they can demand and that their governments are accountable to them and to a wide-ranging body of rights-based national and international law. It is essential that we keep up the momentum, thereby enabling more and more people to stand up and claim their rights.
Craig Machiber says there is an old UN slogan that is as relevant today as when it was coined 15 years ago.
Human rights, know them, demand them, defend them.
That's all in our program on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. A special thanks goes out to our volunteer, Samantha Hoare, who interviewed many of the experts featured in the program. Thank you for listening. You can find our programs on the internet at radio.un.org. I'm Bisera Kostova, and this is United Nations Radio. We'll be right back.